Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Thursday, February 15th, 2024. We have four cases on our calendar today set for oral argument. This is the final and fourth case. This is A23-1479, Robert Weber versus Ron Franks, Responsible Authority, Carver County Health and Human Services. Counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent. And then appellant, you can have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you so choose. The podium does lower and raise. There's a button on the underneath side to raise it. And then you can also adjust the microphone as well. This is being recorded, and the recording will be available within a day or two after the oral arguments here today. And with that, counsel, you may proceed. Please state your name for the record and the party you're representing.
May it please the court. My name is Robert Weber. I'm an attorney. I'm also the plaintiff and appellant in this matter. The government calls you. You're at your office, and the government tells you that you've been accused of various criminal acts, A, B, and C. You deny the allegations, A, B, and C, which are 100% false, and you offer to go to their office that day to talk to them about the allegations. They say that's not necessary, that you can talk to them the next week. Over the weekend, you decide not to cooperate with them. You're exercising your right to remain silent, which is recognized, obviously, in the criminal Miranda statute and warning. Now, after you tell them that you're not going to cooperate with the investigation, and specifically because you tell them you're not going to cooperate with the investigation, the government files an ex parte petition to remove your 11-year-old son from your custody. Your son is disabled. He's removed from your home for 12 months. He's placed in a group residential facility. And for five of those months, he's in a group residential facility where he's brutalized through multiple acts of physical violence. This is according to the independent guardian ad litem. After your son is sexually assaulted in the same facility, he's ordered home, and then the government, sua sponte, dismisses its own investigation. The whole time you've insisted on your innocence of the allegations A, B, and C, and only after the entire ordeal, you learn that, number one, the government is permitted to exercise a negative inference in response to your exercising your right to remain silent, and number two, that the government has a specific statutory obligation, the Tennyson warning, or civil Miranda, to tell you that a collateral consequence of your exercising your right to remain silent is the removal of your child through an ex parte petition. Because the government failed to warn you as required by the statute, you sue. I recite these facts because they're important, and I don't believe that the district court gave due consideration to the issues in this case. I believe that the respondent's counsel has been able to portray this as a nuisance lawsuit by a whining person, and I would say that, look, every plaintiff is a little bit whining, and this court has the opportunity to decide whether there's legal merit to my claims. The lawsuit is in some ways a classic case. Duty, breach of duty, actionable damages, causation. What was Carver County's duty? They were required to provide the Tennyson warning. The Tennyson warning might seem obscure, but it's longstanding. The Tennyson warning says that an individual who is asked to supply private or confidential information or data concerning the individual shall be informed of A, the purpose and intended use of the requested data within the government entity, B, whether the individual may refuse or is legally required to supply the requested data, C, any known consequence arising from supplying or refusing to supply the private or confidential data, and D, the identity or other persons or entities authorized by state or federal law to receive the data. I never got any Tennyson warning at all. The Tennyson warning needed to be provided prior to the ex parte petition. I spoke to the government initially on May 1st, 2020. It was a Friday. I was in my office in downtown Minneapolis. They were in Chaska. This was the first time I ever heard of the allegations. I offered to drive there that day to speak to them. They said that wasn't necessary. Over the weekend, I decided not to cooperate with the investigation. Then on May 4th, Monday, I told them I wasn't going to cooperate with the investigation, and only then did suddenly the situation become imminent danger. The definition of imminent danger means that a child is threatened with immediate and present maltreatment that is life-threatening or likely to result in abandonment, sexual abuse, or serious physical injury. On May 1, when they called me, my son wasn't in imminent danger. On May 2, when they were taking the weekend off. On May 3, only on May 4, after I tell them that I'm not going to cooperate, then they remove my child.
Can I ask you a question about the causation issue? I know you're probably planning to address it, but it would seem to me like your argument would be very strong if the only basis for the ex parte petition were your decision to decline to speak with them, right? That was the only evidence that went into the decision to remove your child. But clearly they had more than that that they relied on in seeking to have the court issue an order to remove your child. And so why isn't that problematic for your causation argument?
Thank you. Causation is an important issue in this case. I believe that the Supreme Court has been clear that there can be multiple causes that justify a trial, that a jury should hear that. The jury in my case should hear my entire testimony. The judge at the district court only relied on selective excerpts. I believe that I've provided sufficient and arguably substantial evidence that the basis of the removal was the lack of cooperation. One of the things that I think this court could consider by analogy is the implied consent advisory that exists in DWI law. In DWI investigations, the government is required to provide the implied consent advisory to let an individual know that there is a collateral consequence if they continue to exercise their right to remain silent. So if a person is being investigated for DWI and the government wants to do a blood or urine test on that individual, they have to provide the timely, complete, and accurate advisory. And this court has been very clear that that's required, and this court doesn't say that that person then has to show what they would have done differently or anything else. The collateral consequence in that situation does not take effect if the warning is not provided.
Counsel, that seems to be a different situation because those consequences are clearly outlined in the implied consent statute of if you do not cooperate, you will be charged with XYZ. So there's that direct connection. My question is, and you seem to acknowledge, including in your reply brief, that there are many links in the causal chain here. And so that's one of the issues that concerns me on the causation is it seems that there are multiple steps. In the implied consent, you don't cooperate. This is a direct result. So that causal link is right there. Here, I think you list at least five maybe different steps in the causal chain.
Well, what I think we're trying to explain in the reply brief is, okay, what was the damage? The damage was the removal of the child. Why was the child removed? Because of the ex parte petition. Why was the ex parte petition issued? Because of the lack of cooperation. We have evidence of all of that. The only question I think that there's basically the least amount of evidence is what would I have done if I had gotten the Tennyson warning? And I think a reasonable juror, which is the standard, we're at summary judgment now, a reasonable juror could believe that if I was told that a consequence for my exercising my right to remain silent would be the ex parte removal of my child, then it's reasonable that I would have behaved differently. I think one of the other things to look at in this case...
Can I stop just for 1 second? Because I actually wanted to ask you along the lines of a hypothetical. Would you agree that if you hadn't been given the Tennyson warning and then no petition to remove your child was ever filed, your child was never removed, but you still felt the stress of the entire investigation, the fact that you had this call, the fact that there were social services involvement, but nothing ever came of it, would you agree under those circumstances that any of the other things that happened, including loss of employment, mental health due to stress, you couldn't say there's a causal link between that kind of damages and that kind of injury and the lack of Tennyson warning under those circumstances. Would you agree?
Well, I think in that circumstance, if the child wasn't removed, then I think that it would be harder to show that you have the kind of actionable emotional damages that occur when a child is removed. And so it is true that it would be harder to show that, and it is true that a lot of the damages are downstream, but my view, and I believe that it's supported by the case law on causation and summary judgment, is that it's for the jurors to decide whether a reasonable person would have acted differently if they had gotten the warning. And there clearly was no warning given. The social workers admitted in the depositions that they didn't give the warning. They said they'd been trained on the warning. They said that they could have given the warning verbally or in writing. They didn't give the warning. The manager of the social workers testified in deposition that in an audit of their files, 50% of the files showed no compliance with the Tennyson warning. Now, I think
in this particular case, you at bottom, you agree that in terms of significant contributing causes, the decision of the social services agency to seek the petition to remove your child and the order, that's a significant contributing intervening cause.
Exactly. I do agree with that. I do agree with that. And frankly, that was the thing that was so upsetting, because on March 4th, there was a statement said that we will potentially get the court involved. Now, court involvement is this: two sides arguing in front of a judge. And my feeling was the initial allegations A, B, and C never occurred. There's no evidence for it. I wanted to go and establish that, and then I assumed that the case would be over. But they filed an ex parte petition. Essentially, they have weaponized the ex parte petition process, because they can just simply declare imminent danger. And there was no imminent danger on May 1, there was no imminent danger on May 2, there was no imminent danger on May 3, but on May 4, I tell them I'm not cooperating, then they declare imminent danger, and that means that they can take your child ex parte, you have no defense from it. And the result of that sort of drove me mad. And there was a point, and this I think was part of the brief, that I basically am like, just take my kids, because there's no point in me even ever being a parent if the government can show up, accuse you of something that's totally wrong, tell you to cooperate, you want to fight them, and then they take your kids.
Were you told that you needed to engage in a safety plan in order to have your child live with you?
So I was told that. What happened, not before they took my kids. So what happened in the case was that they took my kid. We had an evidentiary hearing about a month late, middle of the month in May. As part of the evidentiary hearing, the requirement to get my child back was to engage in safety planning, which I did. I did engage in safety planning in June. I did it specifically to get my son back before Father's Day. But then they changed the deal. And throughout the entire year, they kept changing the deal of what I had to do to get my son back. And it was driving me mad, because the whole case was based on false allegations from the beginning. And that was essentially what drove me mad in the entire case. And to support the whole thing, they dismissed their own case. After my son was sexually assaulted, they dismissed the whole case.
Were you told at any time that if you didn't cooperate, you might have your child taken away from you? Were you ever told that?
I was not told that before my child was taken away. I mean, what they did is they took my child away, and then they held my child, and they said, do this, and you can get your child back. And then I would do that, and they're like, no, that's not enough. Do this, then you can get your child back. And then I would try to do that. So along the way, there was the safety planning in June. There was a settlement in August. I had to hire this special parental reunification agency, which I did. In October, they offered him to me without any precondition. In October, they offered him to me. I agreed to take him, and then they changed their mind. Then they let me talk to him every single day in the month of November. Then they barred me from speaking to him the entire 5 months he was in this totally inappropriate facility, and all of these bad things happened. On the issue of causation, I think one of the things that this court has to consider is that if you accept the county's position on causation, essentially they want to position things like, look, we didn't give Tennyson, but it doesn't matter because no one really changes their behavior because of Tennyson. And in this way, It is analogous to the case Jepson versus Pope County, a relatively high-profile case that involved the death of a boy, Eric Dean. In that case, Pope County basically said, we never notify law enforcement. That's just not what we do. And they, of course, tried to hide behind official immunity, and the state Supreme Court said, you don't get official immunity, you're subject to due care standards. And I think that one of the themes there is that the social workers don't get to decide the law. The legislature passes the laws, and then the social workers have to comply with the laws. The Tennyson warning is clearly a law. They clearly did not comply with the Tennyson warning. There were damages, and it's up to the jury to decide whether the failure to give the Tennyson warning was a contributing factor to the damages. The other point I want to make in my brief time left is that I did plead exemplary damages, and exemplary damages do not require causation. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And you all have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you so choose. Counsel for respondent, you will have 15 minutes for your arguments. Please state your name and for the record and the party you are representing.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Ann Gehring, and I'm here representing Rod Franks. He is the only defendant in this case, and that is a key point, possibly the point at which this case should be resolved. My client, Mr. Weber, has admitted that Rod Franks has done nothing wrong.
But isn't he the representative for the county?
No, he is the responsible authority, and he is the defendant. And he and during his deposition, Mr. Weber admitted that Rod Franks didn't do anything wrong. The county was not sued in this case. Only Rod Franks was sued. Rod, and in under state law, under the Data Practices Act, you have a choice. You can sue either the responsible authority, or you can sue the county directly, or you can sue both. To sue the responsible authority, you have this responsible authority must have done something wrong himself. In this case, Mr. Franks did nothing wrong. There are specific requirements of a responsible authority, what they must do and must not do.
What about 1305 subdivision 4, duties of responsible authority?
Correct.
Limitations on collection and use of data. Private or confidential data on an individual shall not be collected. Unless essentially it's done in accordance with 1304, the Tennyson warning.
Correct, so but he did not. Right.
Right, but isn't, I mean, that very phrase uses the term government entities. So, I mean, it's his responsibility as the responsible authority to ensure that the government entity that he's affiliated with follows the Tennyson law, isn't it? Isn't that one of his duties?
His duty is to ensure that there are policies and procedures in place. He does not, under the case law, Wills versus Jessam, he does not have a respondeat superior liability for the actions of the employees. If they want to sue for the actions of an employee, he has an obligation as the responsible authority to have policies and procedures in place. He cannot personally be sued for the actions of the employees of Carver County. If you want to sue, if an employee of Carver County violated the law or violated a policy or procedure, they sue the county. That's what we always do in Minnesota. That's what the law is. You sue the county, which you can do under 13.08. You don't sue the responsible authority. He, under the Jessam versus Wills versus Jessam case, which this court has decided, you don't sue the responsible authority. You sue the government entity directly. There's no respondeat superior. You can, and that is decided in Walker versus Scott County. You can absolutely sue the government entity directly.
I mean, it's kind of illusory to include the responsible authority under 1308. Right? Because is there ever a situation in which an individual responsible authority is giving Tennyson warnings? I suppose in a very small county.
Not for the Tennyson warning, but for all kinds of other things. If there are, you can sue them for all kinds of things. Not having the policies or procedures in place. Not responding to government data. So when we see responsible authorities being sued is You make a data request to the responsible authority, which is what you do. You don't make a response. You don't make a data request to Carver County. You make it to the responsible authority. If they don't turn up, if they don't turn the data over, you sue the responsible authority for refusing to comply with the Data Practices Act. But that's why they're listed.
The 1308 subdivision 1 says any provision of this chapter, and it seems like what you're arguing is any provision of this chapter except for Tennyson.
Well, if the responsible authority was doing that, yes, sure.
You would agree that it'd be pretty rare for a responsible authority to be the person picking up the phone to call and interview Mr. Weber about a child protection situation and have to ever give a Tennyson warning, right?
There are numerous responsible authorities in every county, in every government entity. So the Director of Human Services is one responsible authority. The sheriff is a responsible authority. The county administrator is a responsible authority. There's all kinds of responsible authorities within any government entity. So any one of them can be sued for failing to give a Tennyson warning under the right circumstances. So in this case, you have a choice. He could have sued both the responsible authority for failing to have the policies and procedures in place, or he could have sued either one. And he has admitted at his deposition that Mr. Franks didn't do anything wrong, that he had all the policies and procedures in place, that he did all the training, that he followed every single duty that he had actually under the statute. And that's set forth in our materials. And the Jessup case says you can't actually bring an action against, you have the case right here that this court has already decided, you can't bring this against the responsible authority for the actions of a subordinate employee or another employee of the county. So, and then the Minnesota Supreme Court has already, in the Adams versus Harpstead case, said yes, they look favorably upon that ruling. So that has been decided already, that you can't just say, yes, an employee did this, but we're going to hold it against a responsible authority. You have the choice of suing the county directly for that. And that didn't happen in this case. So that part, we can decide that separately. Mr. Weber, and I don't know how, the 1983 cases, of course, you can't bring this action against, you can't go out to the 1983 cases that is only, the 1983 cases that were cited in his materials as saying, well, a suit against the responsible authority is the same thing as a suit against the county. It isn't. That case law only applies to federal statutes, and the 11th Amendment cases, of course, only apply against matters brought against the state of Minnesota, employees of the state of Minnesota.
But you would say the limits of his responsibility are just to, the responsible authority's responsibility is just to make sure there's policies in place, not to ensure that the policies are actually being followed? I mean, that would seem to defeat the purpose, right? I mean, anyone could just have a policy manual and never give it to any of their employees.
Well, there's responsibilities. It's set out what the training and duties are, but it is not it is not their responsibility to follow every employee of the county around every day and make sure that they're doing every single thing that they're supposed to. If that were the case, then we'd be suing them individually for the actions of the coworkers. And we don't have respondeat superior against one person for the actions of another person. That's against their employer, not against their coworker. They're their coworker.
Doesn't Section 13.04 Subdivision 2 of the MGPDA outline the requirement for Tennyson warnings?
Yes.
And doesn't that fall under the purview of the responsible authority?
That is their duty to ensure that there are Tennyson warnings given, yes.
So why wouldn't the responsible authority be a proper defendant in this case and at the district court level?
That they have ensured that is the duties of the Tennyson warnings are given by the entity? Yes.
Correct.
That is a policy of the entity, yes. It doesn't say in there that the responsible authority gives these Tennyson warnings.
I understand that, but isn't the responsible authority responsible for making sure that the Tennyson warnings are provided?
It doesn't say that they have to. That isn't what the statute says.
The statute does mandate Tennyson warnings under Subdivision 2 of Section 13.04.
Correct.
And that's one of the policies that responsible authority is responsible for. Correct.
Correct. And there's absolutely a policy that's. County, the responsible authority has ensured, and we have.
Plaintiff is alleging that it wasn't carried out, and isn't that the responsibility of the responsible authority to make sure that those warnings are given?
That's not what the statute says. That they're responsible ensuring that there is a policy. But to say that the responsible authority as an employee must ensure that every single employee of Carver County is doing it every single time and that they would be personally responsible for it.
But the responsibility for carrying out the policy is the responsibility of the responsible authority.
That isn't what the statute says.
Okay.
It says that they are responsible for ensuring that there is a policy and procedures in place. There are policies and procedures in place.
So you only have 6 minutes left. So I'm curious as to your thoughts on the more substantive part of it beyond the procedure here.
The procedure? I'm sorry.
The substantive arguments here.
Okay. I believe that this case can be dismissed because they sued the wrong party, and that should resolve the matter. As far as the causal matter, I did want to just briefly talk about what's not in our thing. This case, substantively, you can look in the record, Mr. Weber's child was not in his custody, was not living in his home, was not with him when he was contacted on May 1st. He stated that he would not see his son over that weekend. Then he stated that no, he was not going to cooperate, and he was going to go and get his son from the facility and where he was living, which was outside of the home. He was not placed in his home. At that point, because there was going to be a delay, and he was going to go and see his son before he could be interviewed, the county took action to go get an ex parte order. The Tennyson warning does not go into effect before you request or require information. This idea that somehow there has to be a Tennyson warning before you take somebody's child, there's nothing in that. He's confusing the Tennyson warning, which is a data practices policy statute, and the CHIPS statute, the child protection statute. These are not the same thing. The child protection statute is a separate statute that is not before you here today, but seems to be tried to be brought in here. They had a reason to go into court to protect that child, and they did, separate from any Tennyson warning. Nothing in the CHIPS statute says you have to give somebody a Tennyson warning. What they do, what the Tennyson warning says, is if you're requesting or requiring information from somebody, you have to give a Tennyson warning. There's nothing in the law that says you have to give a Tennyson warning before going into court to get an order, an ex parte order. That simply doesn't exist. You have to give a Tennyson warning before you request or require information from a person. There was no interview with Mr. Weber even scheduled until the following Monday. Mr. Weber declined to be interviewed. He sent an email saying he had contacted an attorney, he wasn't going to talk to them. So this whole idea that his child was taken from him because of the refusal to give information, it's at the time, you give a Tennyson warning at the time you're requesting or requiring information. They never met with him. There was no opportunity to give him a Tennyson warning. There was a meeting scheduled that was canceled. They went to court and got the child, and then there was a court hearing scheduled for May 15th, at which time the judge told him very specifically, I will read this to you. The judge told him, there is no chance that there is going to be a return of the children without a safety plan. Open court, the judge, on the 15th of May. And this was told over and over again. The child had already been removed before anyone talked to him. The judge told him, you're not getting your kids back until you safety plan. Talk to the social worker. And as set forth in our brief, there's multiple opportunities that he was told all kinds of information. This is what we need from you. This is what will happen. The Tennyson warning says any known consequences of providing or not providing this information. Mr. Weber is under the impression that somehow the county knew that the judge was going to take the kids away. What the judge was going to put in the safety plan, what the judge was going to put in the case plan. The county only knows what it knows, but they don't decide what happens to these kids. They can bring information to the court, but the judge decides to take a child away. The judge decides what to put into the plan. This is a part of a process of child protection that is not a decision of the county to say, I know that if you don't do this, I know that this is what's going to happen. the known consequences. This isn't a known consequence. It's a possibility, but there's all kinds of possibilities. If he had safety plan, the kids probably would have stayed home with him. We knew that, and the judge told him. He refused to do that, so the different consequences fell from that. What were the known consequences? The known consequences were what the judge told him on May 15th. But the kids were out of the home already, and no information was requested from him prior to that because he canceled the meeting. There was also this, we know that there was no meeting in person because this was during COVID. It was in May of 2020, so there were no in-person meetings. There was no opportunity to hand him a sheet of paper. This had to happen by telephone in different settings. So they were not having in-person meetings. Some things were being sent by email. They were on the phone.
A Tennyson warning, right?
What?
They could have emailed them a Tennyson warning.
Presumably,
they were communicating by email, presumably, right?
And meetings were being scheduled at a sheriff. And I know there was a police officer involved in this, too. So
in your last 30 seconds, you want to address the causation argument about exemplary damages?
Yeah, there's not been any damages at all, and certainly there's been no exemplary damages. There's no evidence in this case of any intentional conduct by anyone. There were no admissions here by that anybody with Carver County. And again, Carver County isn't a defendant here. It isn't. There's one defendant. It's Rod Franks. So how can there be exemplary damages against Rod Franks for anything? Rod Franks did not intentionally fail to give a Tennyson warning. Rod Franks wasn't involved here. There was an interview. There's admissions by Mr. Weber that Mr. Franks didn't do anything wrong. So how can there be any causal connection here, saying that Mr. Franks should be exemplary damages against Mr. Franks when he's admitted that Mr. Franks never did anything wrong at all, let alone anything intentionally wrong. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Let's start first with what I call the Simon Says argument. They say that I didn't sue the right party because I didn't say Simon Says. I sued the responsible authority in his official capacity, and that constitutes a suit against Carver County. It's very long-standing policy and practice. I call it the doctrine of alternative pleading. It's been recognized and established by the U.S. Supreme Court. It's been used by this court. It's been used by the Minnesota Supreme Court. It's been used by federal courts in interpreting the Data Practices Act. What respondent wants you to do is abrogate the doctrine of alternative pleading for lawsuits in state court, but not in federal court, if you sue the responsible authority.
But in order to abrogate, there has to be a state law in place. Is there any state law applying that doctrine in AMG PDA?
Well, the doctrine isn't the doctrine is not specifically a state law, but it's the practice of when you sue a government official in his official capacity, it constitutes a lawsuit against his employer. See, this was a successful argument for her recently in the Benda Common Sense case, where somebody sued a designated, not the official responsible authority. And that's not what I did. I sued someone that was under the statute. They accepted service. Carver County paid for their counsel to represent them. They revealed in discovery all the confidential documentation. If you accept that argument, the idea is that I just have to start the whole lawsuit over and sue Carver County because somehow Carver County had no idea that this all was going on. The appellate rules state that when you sue a government official and that official changes, like an elected official, you just change the name of the person in the pleading because we know who it involves.
Right, but my question is, you're relying on the doctrine of alternative pleading, but is there any binding Minnesota state case law that applies the doctrine of alternative pleading to an MGPDA claim?
No, and Wills v. Jessen also does not discuss the doctrine of alternative pleading. So the district court relied on a case that is completely silent on the issue of alternative pleading. The district court cannot find persuasive a case that doesn't even discuss the doctrine. Now, this court could expand Wills v. Jessen and expand the doctrine, but for what reason? What would be the purpose here to not allow this to be a claim against Carver County? I have not sued Rod Franks in his personal capacity. Wills v. Jessen included a lawsuit in personal capacity. And I think it's very interesting that Judge Jessen, formerly Commissioner Jessen, argued the doctrine of alternative pleading in federal court in a Data Practices Act case. She was the defendant in Wills v. Jessen. She never even brought up any of these issues. That was a sua sponte issue brought up in Wills v. Jessen. And if you look back at the Adams case, which is a precedent decision, it does not cite favorably for this issue. So I want that to be clear that I don't think that's a reason to get rid of this case. Causation is a real issue. It's a close call. I think that's worth looking at, but I believe that I'm right on causation. If you look also at the breach, did Carver County comply with the Tennyson warning? Everything's being obscured here. It's as if they have to give me the Tennyson warning before they take my child if the basis is communicating with them. That's what I've laid out. That's what the case is. After your child is taken, the hypothetical that I think is worth...
But don't they have to give it to you at the time they actually interview you? I mean, you just
they can give it...
And then you told them that you were not going to sit with them, and you told them you're going to go get your son, right? So there's several intervening causes there that I think, I mean, maybe take this case out of the rare situation where causation is left to the jury. What's your response to that?
Yeah, well, so consider another hypothetical where the Tennyson warning would apply. If a manager says to a subordinate, I need your social security number to do this report, and the subordinate says, I'm not giving you the social security number, and the manager says, you're fired, and then a week later, the manager calls the subordinate and says, the reason you're fired is because you didn't give the social security number. That's what's happened here. The reason we took your child is because you didn't cooperate. They needed to tell you that at the beginning of the case. They don't take your child and then tell you after they take your child, well, you're supposed to cooperate. So the timing is very important here.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you
both for your arguments and your briefing on this case. It has been submitted, and we will be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory time frame.
Thank you.
That is our fourth and final case for today. The court is now in recess. Thank you all.
Please rise.